check it out now. No doubt now.
It's the Beating the Book podcast. Gil Alexander. Time for another in our series of sports betting profiles during this global pandemic. Today, on the heels of so many who have been kind enough to give us their time and provide insights on the show during this strange time in all of our lives, it's Joe Pita. Joe Pita, author, a Wall Street guy, if you will, someone who has had flirtations with all kinds of things sports betting related, and we'll get to some of those, including what I feel is perhaps the biggest story around the sports betting industry that never got told over the last few years in Las Vegas and beyond. Joe was right in the mix with that. He's got all the insights. And just all the different ways that he's been pulled into the sports betting arena, whether he wanted to by design or not. Fascinating guy, super smart, always a friend of the podcast. We're happy to have him as part of our series here today. Enjoy. Joe Pita on the Beating the Book podcast.
It's a numbers game with your host, Gil Alexander.
It's one of those idiots who believe in analytics.
It is a numbers game on a Tuesday. It's Gil Alexander, SiriusXM Channel 204, Visa.com, the Visa app, Fubo, Sling, and Game Plus. How you doing? Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're doing well. On the show today, we'll talk about baseball's latest ridiculous 50-game plan, if that's going to be a thing. Not a formal offer, but a default offer, if you will. But today is a Tuesday, and for those who have been keen observers of this show during the pandemic, Tuesdays pretty much reserved for a betting profile series that I've done. If not now, when? Our chance to sort of get into the minds of really influential people in the business and from all angles. Alan Boston has been with us for the series. Rufus Peabody, Dr. Bob, Captain Jack Andrews, Dink, Alan Dankinson, Ray Marino, Spanky was here last week. Today, it's an old friend of mine who is fascinating in so many ways. And honestly, with him, I hope to reveal the biggest untold story or story that could have been, if you will, in Las Vegas the last three, 4 years. It ended up having a conclusion, but something was simmering under for a big betting company for so many years. That's just one aspect of him. But he has a Wall Street background, a major accident in his life that changed his life and steered him towards this industry, if you will. It's Joe Pita, everybody. How you doing, Joe? Good morning to you, and thanks for spending the time.
Good morning, Gil. It's you're right. We are old friends. It goes back, I think, to 2011, maybe now, or maybe 2012 preseason is when we met for tacos in San Francisco.
Where did we meet for tacos? I don't even remember this. Where did we meet for tacos?
Taco-licious down on Chestnut.
That's right. Taco-licious, which now has a different Chestnut location.
That's right. We were early
yes.
adopters.
That's right. We really were. By the way, Joe, for those who listened to the Beating the Book podcast for many years and a numbers game, obviously the author of Trading Bases, which we'll get to, and Joe Pita's Masters Tour Guide from 2019, which is a whole nother thing. That's the thing that makes you so interesting, Joe, is there are so many tentacles to this next hour with you. And you know, not to sound like James Lipton from Inside the Actor Studio, the late, great James Lipton, it should be mentioned. But we always start at the beginning. Where did you grow up? Did you have a financial background in your family that led you to Wall Street? And what were your first experiences with betting?
Yeah, so no, I grew up outside Philadelphia. My father was a professor, immigrant. And as an immigrant and with a first name, Erminio, which immediately announced his sort of foreign presence. His parents didn't speak English. And so one of the things he did to try to be American was adopt baseball. So this is in the era of the 30s and 40s. So he grew up in Philly. So he adopted the Phillies, of course. But he loved Joe DiMaggio, obviously, as an Italian-American sort of representing the sport. And so that was passed on to me. As far as financial stuff, not really. He did teach me to read the stock tables on a summer vacation, I remember, down at the Jersey Shore. And that became, I then became somewhat obsessed with that. And, you know, like the title of your show, it's a numbers game. And I was fascinated by the numbers. I was into the parlay cards. A buddy of mine, well, I happened to be lucky because in homeroom in high school, his last name was Pavin, which sat right in front of me, PETA. And his dad was known as Augie the Bookie. And Augie, so he would come in with these parlay cards. And, you know, I couldn't get enough of those. And I that got me sort of hooked on the game. But it wasn't as prevalent back then. You know, I remember going to college. I went, you know, and then sticking with the numbers, I went down to Virginia Tech to become a CPA, graduated in accounting, and then moved up to DC, where I was a tax advisor with some famous clients. I think I've said this to you. I don't think I've said it on the air, but one of my former tax clients was Paul Manafort, who is now in jail for, among other things, tax fraud. That was the type of rich and famous clientele that was in DC at the time. But I remember betting on sports then. Again, you know, you had the bookie, whether it was Legs or Tony or Augie. It was the score line, the score phone, right? That was the man calling the score phone was such a big deal. I can still hear those recorded voices in that. My head.
Yeah.
But it was always a hobby, right? I viewed it as something to try to crack, but I understood the entertainment aspect of it too. There was never a stigma around it to me because, like I said, I viewed it as part of the entertainment industry. Then my professional path then was to get to Wall Street. You know, after being an accountant for so long, I wanted to get to Wall Street. And, you know, again, similar game, right? You're trying to allocate capital based on incomplete information, which is, you know, sort of sums up sports betting as well. So I ended up got a graduate degree, ended up going up to Wall Street. And now I was really, my colleagues were my people. I didn't realize how well established the New York City betting market was. So now you got people to talk to all day about it. And it became, you know, a much bigger part of my life. Like you say, 15 years into that career, so I guess that was 2010 now, I did get injured in New York. I got, as you said, there was an accident. I got run over by an ambulance while I was a pedestrian. And that laid me up and had me in a wheelchair for a little bit. And that's when I had the, sort of percolating in my mind was this idea that the critical reasoning overlap between asset management and sports betting and then the moneyballization of baseball, they were all related to me. I saw overlaps where one industry did something better than the other two. And you know, you could find something for points for all of them. And I had the idea to put it into a book. And that's how Trading Bases came about. I had never written anything. I got very lucky. I was fortunate that the movie Moneyball came out in the, I guess, fall of 2011, just as I was pitching the book to publishers. And it had a good elevator pitch because the elevator pitch was very understandable. It was Moneyball meets Bringing Down the House. So there you have two books that were successful books. They were both, well, Moneyball wasn't a memoir, but it was easily understood by the publishing industry, and you know that was fortunate. Because the movie was doing so well, there are a lot of publishers wanted a piece of it. So that's how the book came about. And the book came out. And then it gets interesting. This is how I met you. So the book gets written in 2011, submitted early 2012 for early 2013 publication. And the publisher liked the initial manuscript, you know, very much. And they said, we're going to need an epilogue, though, for 2012, because if, you know, for people who haven't read the book, it's essentially, it's a chronological account of 2011, really starting with my accident. And so the, and it goes into, you know, a lot of stories. It is a memoir. So it's my stories of Wall Street. It's my stories of growing up in a baseball family and how, you know, the fandom of baseball is in there. And then, of course, the betting. And the, we get to 2012 and they said, we're going to need an epilogue for 2012. And they said, we have this idea. We want to kind of run it by you. What would you think about going to Vegas with the marketing budget for the book and betting on baseball legally so that, you know, we could tell that story? And I thought, that sounds like a baseball betting fund to me. That sounds like a great idea. And so then I called up family and friends, and that's where I met you, called up family and friends. And I'm like, you know, my degenerate buddies, if they know I'm going out there, they're going to want a piece of this.
One could say we were entity betting when we weren't supposed to. Maybe. I don't know. Some might charge that. Who knows?
I always likened it. I rationalized it to the guy who collects lottery ticket money from his bowling buddies to cross state lines and you know and bet on the lotto where it's in a state where it's legal.
Let me step in here for a second because we glossed over something that, you know, it was a cataclysmic event in your life, and that is the getting run over by an ambulance. You can't really say that sentence and then just go on. You had been through a lot, right? You were at Lehman Brothers, I believe, when the financial meltdown happened, and that was just its own, you know, just the 9/11 of that industry, if you will. And so I worked at,
you know, the World Financial Center on 9/11 too. So it was a very eventful 15 years. I'm sorry, but go on.
Well, no. What was your 9/11 experience real quick? I mean, how was that day?
Well, yeah, it was surreal. Our building was attached to the North Tower via a footbridge. So I, you know, walk through that lobby every morning at about 6:45. I actually had a window desk to the West Side Highway. And I remember the first explosion, the first plane hitting, I actually looked down from my window because I thought maybe it was a car accident or so. I looked down and did not see the sort of impact for about 3 or 4 seconds. So it was still unclear what happened in the North Tower with you just see the gaping hole and the smoke starting to billow. So there's a lot of confusion about what was going on. I thought it was a gas line break, person, you know, that was just my guess. There's an explosion up there. And then you start hearing the reports, a small plane, but we're still at the windows. And then we see the second plane come in. Yeah, what's that, 40 minutes later, I think it was. And then you have no question at all about what's going on. And that was left the building and actually never walked in that building again. And I lived on 18th Street at the time. So walked, stayed down there. And for people who know Lower Manhattan there, Stuyvesant High School was just north of the North Tower. And at that point, it wasn't so built up. So there were actually parking lots and baseball fields and tennis courts right on the West Side Highway. So stood there out in sort of the baseball fields for quite some time watching. That was, you know, that's seared. It's that was tough.
I, I mean, you live through then, and so many people, and you know, everyone in New York has a 9/11 story, and one more tragic than the previous. So you led the entire New York experience. So you lived through 9/11, 2008, Lehman Brothers, and you write extensively about Lehman Brothers in your book, Trading Bases, how a Wall Street trader made a fortune betting on baseball, which, by the way, I think was a second subtitle to that book, if I'm not mistaken. Wasn't there like a not necessarily in that order subtitle?
Yeah, my subtitle, which was on the hardcover, was a story about Wall Street gambling and baseball, not necessarily in that order.
That's right.
And when the paperback books rights were sold from my publisher to a different publisher, they, in the publishing industry, the publisher really owns the cover, the outside of the book. You own the words inside. So they changed the subtitle to make it a little more dramatic. I was never pleased with it. It to me, that wasn't the story. And fortune is such a, I guess, relative word. I would never have characterized it like that. But you know, that's publishing, and the story is inside. But
so yeah, and so again, so you live this, and it's just the quintessential New York experience. One tragedy after the next, one of a different kind than the other. And then you have your own personal one with the literally, and you know, you glossed over it, but you were on the ground, and we're going to have to go to break here, so I want to pick this up right after the break, Joe. But you were literally on the ground in New York City looking down at your mangled leg. And, you know, I get chills even sort of saying that because when I ruptured my Achilles, right, there's that moment where it's all surreal and it's all happening to you. This was, I mean, what happened to me is nothing would happen to you. Like, your leg was just destroyed. And this is where it transformed, as you point out. You was like, hey, what if I apply these principles to my first love of sports betting? I want to get into that summer of 2012 when you did the betting there, and what your biggest takeaway from your experience for half a baseball season was in Las Vegas from that, and then move on to what I think is the biggest single story, untold story, in all of Las Vegas, and Joe was front lines for that. It has to do with a big betting company. Coming back right here on the Numbers Game at Visa and the Sports Betting Network. It is Gil Alexander live in San Francisco, doing betting profiles throughout the pandemic. So interesting that Joe Pita is right across the city from me, west of where I am. And, you know, we'd have to arrange to even meet each other, obviously, in these very strange times. But going through his story, and it just gets more fascinating from here, as if you hadn't lived through enough. By the way, was the use of the word mangled appropriate when you looked down at your leg when the ambulance hit you?
Yes, and you and I, yes, being of similar ages, and we certainly remember Joe Theismann. I viewed it as a Joe, yes, Theismann situation.
Oh, I was there for the Joe Theismann game, by the way. Yes, this was not fun. By the way, if I can recommend anything for you, the E60 episode on Alex Smith is just a sight to behold.
Can't watch it. Will not be able to think about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'm recommending it to the wrong person, but anybody out there, yeah, I can tell you. By the way, and here's a ridiculous detail, but for some reason, my dumb human brain wants to know this. What intersection was this in New York City?
Oh, gosh, West Broadway and Church, I think, down. So it was right at the corner of, at the time, where the proposed mosque was going to be. I lived on Murray Street, right? We had an apartment on Murray Street for my work in New York, and it was just a block south of that. So West Broadway, and I think it was Church, which was a block south of Murray. And so because of the location and because of the police presence that was around there at the time, I was attended to very quickly by some city personnel. But on the other hand, it was a very, yes, it was an intersection, therefore, that had cameras all over. And the FDNY claimed that there was no footage of the accident when it came to discuss the legal ramifications.
Compensating, so, yes. Yeah. Okay. So you're convalescing. you're like, hey, I can apply my Wall Street principles to the love of my life, baseball, betting. I love that as a child. It produces the book Trading Spaces. And as you say, a great case study for them. They were like, look, let's put this into action for the epilogue of the book. Go to Vegas and put this to the test. And so you go there, and I was with you for much of this. I know you stayed in your little kitchenette place at Trump over there, and you did this every day. And in the end, first of all, was it a winning or losing proposition? Let's get that out of the way.
Yeah, it was not, Gil. The period I was there was July 4th through the end of the season. I had a great 2011. 2012 got off to a good start. And July, the first 5 weeks, July through the second week of August, was brutal. I remember it was highlighted by the very first night there with Sabathia and Rivera blowing a 4-0 lead in the, which should have told me something, on I think it was July 1st. And later in July, the low point might have been the third week in July when the Nationals blew, and Strasburg on the mound blew like an 8-0 lead to the Braves. And that was the low point. So it was a very brutal, rough 3.5-week start that got me in a hole that I didn't get out of, which made me, of course, feel bad for the outside capital that had come in. And which is obviously why I don't like the title of that book either, because that was something that was never emphasized. What was really I was trying to emphasize was the building of a model and the, like we said, the critical reasoning overlap between these pursuits.
Yeah, I can remember a night or two. I remember one where a usually mild-mannered Joe Pita got into it with other people in a sports book over the outcome of a game. They had no idea how much was riding on it for you.
Dan Straley. Yeah, Dan Straley. He got called up. This is worth telling. Because I don't think I think we've talked. We said, hey, we should tell this on the air sometime, and never did. But I'll try to make it quick. Dan Straley, this was probably August, late August, I believe, got called up by the A's to make his first start. And at the time, I was using a lot of minor league analytics from one of the original Baseball Prospectus guys, Clay Davenport. And the numbers did not like Dan Straley. And it was, so they were playing Toronto that night, and the thing opened, I think, at the A's at like minus 130, 135, and I'm piling on Toronto.
Tell you what, Joe, I hate to say this, I gotta take a break. I want to tell the Dan Straley story, and I want to get the biggest takeaway from, because I think the bigger point is your biggest takeaway from your Wall Street background of how ridiculous you found the sports betting industry in Vegas, obviously pre-legalization. We'll get into that. And then the biggest story never told. Coming back on A Numbers Game at Visa with Joe Pita right here on the Sports Betting Network.
With Gil Alexander.
A Numbers Game proudly brought to you by Manscaped.com. Manscaped.com is the tools for your family jewels. You get 20% off plus free shipping with the code Visa at Manscaped.com. That's 20% off at Manscaped.com with promo code VSIN. It's Gil Alexander. Joe Pita, kind enough to join us today on the show, the author of Trading Bases, and Joe Pita's tour guide presents a 2019 Masters preview. My goodness, we'll get to that eventually too. But let's get back into this story here. This is from 2012. This is your summer in Las Vegas betting baseball. This will start out as a very funny story, but will actually lead into the broadest point that was your biggest takeaway of that summer.
Yeah, so as we were talking before the break, Dan Straley's making his debut. I'm modeled pretty hard against Dan to fade him, and Toronto's an underdog that night. I think it opened like minus 135 plus 125, and I start putting money on Toronto. And as can happen, you get some limits, and you know, and then you wait, and then you can go back to the counter. But meanwhile, in the 2 hours before the leading up to the game, the odds keep going up on Oakland. So it's price for me, and Toronto's getting better and better, but by the same token, now that's making my expected, as I calculated it, edge higher and higher, which is demanding to put more and more of the fund in until it eventually reached a 2% play, which meant it was going to be about a $20,000 play. So that's what I have on the game, maybe at a blended rate of 145. And you're right, and I'll let you come back to that. The way I had to bet that, I found aggravating in that I was being limited, and then they would make the price better as I'm sitting there. So that was just – that's not the way we work on Wall Street when we price stocks. And there's a much more efficient way to do it, and we can get to that. But so, yeah, so – and, of course, Dan Straley's in trouble all night. But, you know, he's stranding guys at you know, at some 80% clip or something. And I think it's 4-2 entering the night. And I'm just sulking. Like, I'm very quiet. I'm sinking in my chair. I'm at the Westgate. And I can't remember who the closer was for Oakland at the time, but it was, again, a guy that I did not like. And it was clear he was hanging sliders. You could just see it. And I'm like, somebody's going to jump on one. And sure enough, one runner on, two outs, somebody tied it on a hanging slider and drilled it into the left field. And I must have come out of my seat 5-6 feet in the air. And so it's tying the game at 4. And because I could see it coming, and I just exploded. And you know, I'm sure I made some sound. And there was a group of like 6 guys to my right. And they're looking, and the one guy goes, yeah, guy has $10 on the over. And
that, if he only knew.
That set me off. And that's when it just – then it was essentially me versus 8 guys. And that game ended up going to the 15th or 16th inning. It was a terrible experience. And of course, Oakland won the game in like 16 innings. So, it was Coco Crisp threw out a guy in like the 13th from deep in left field. It was painful.
What it was representative of was the thing that I remember most from that summer, which is from your Wall Street background. Again, you're like, this is so primitive, the way they do business here. Explain that.
Yeah, we have something on Wall Street that we call sales trading. And, you know, there's traders who are your market makers. And then there's people who are trying to, they're, you know, salesmen, brokers, you can call them what you want. We call them sales traders. And what there's an art to sales trading. And what it is, it's an attempt to bring buyers and sellers together and find that price discovery, hopefully maybe after the market maker has stepped in and started by maybe committing some capital. And so to me, and this happened over and over in the summer, whether I was at the Wynn or this night happened to be at the Westgate, I did almost all my business there. And the third one was the Venetian, which was a Cantor book, which was my first introduction to Cantor. And we can get into that. And later in the summer, Riviera turned their book over to William Hill. That was William Hill's first outpost in Vegas. And that was, not surprisingly, a bad experience. But it was, what used to bother me was I would be limited on a bet. And I would be sitting there, and they knew me, you know, at this point I'm in every day, and the odds would go up essentially at a better price than I was trying to get when they were limiting me. And I didn't understand why nobody was ever saying, hey, Joe, come here. You know, either we got somebody on the other side, but like, how much would you do here? You know, and that's the art of sales trading. It's knowing your customer. It's opening them up so that you can put together a bigger trade. And I viewed that as a huge opportunity, especially if the state and the industry was trying to attract the entity bettors. To me, one of the reasons they were never going to succeed is they didn't know how to handle entities. They didn't know how to sales trade, in my parlance. That was, you know, that was one of my observations of the industry that summer. And I think that was the other thing you asked for my takeaway was it's a grind. I mean, that was a grind. Cantor was the only one that had anything that resembled mobile betting at the time, which is kind of a funny story in itself. But that led me, because I tried to get to know everyone, that led me to meeting a few times with Leah Matus, who at the time was the CEO of Cantor. And I became fascinated with their business model.
became fascinated with their business model, which, again, I don't want to run into a break and get that started. But essentially, Joe's experience then in 2012, again, from the Wall Street background, realizing some of the inefficiencies in how Vegas sportsbooks do business. By the way, that part has not changed to this day. It's not as if that model has been adopted in any way. Sportsbooks are going to do what sportsbooks do. But it got you fascinated in the business operations. And then maybe this is a stretch to say this, but led Joe to kind of want to take over in a certain way. Those are my words, not Joe's. We'll get into Joe's involvement with the story, the biggest story that has been untold, I would say, in the 3 years of VEASAN, the biggest story that has been untold, mostly because most people didn't know about it. I did, but there was never a story to actually go on air with, was the sale of CG Technology that was out there for a very long time for a song. Was available for a song, relatively speaking, Joe's involvement with that and how its origins may have actually been in the greatest game Wall Street ever played. Joe's got some roots in that as well. Trust me, this is good. Coming back on A Numbers Game at Visa, the Sports Betting Network.
Welcome back to A Numbers Game with Gil Alexander.
Don't forget, now's the time to become a VSiN Plus subscriber. It's free. You won't have to decide what you want to do, pay or cancel, until at least one of the major sports returns. Just go to VSiN.com/subscribe to sign up. That's VSiN.com/subscribe. It's Gil Alexander. It is Joe Pita, author of Trading Bases and Joe Pita's Masters Tour Guide, which we'll get into. But first, this story, which is, okay, so you've gotten to this point. You started to meet some of the guys over there at, it was Cantor Gaming back in the day, then it became CG Technology. Take us from there and explain to us how deep this actually got.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, that summer, I saw, you know, a lot of inefficiencies. And what I saw with Cantor was, so here I'm complaining that there's an entity betting law that nobody is attempting to take advantage of. Which would require, pockets of capital, right, to commit themselves to being betting entities. And at the same time, you have one sports book in Vegas, and let's give them credit. They sort of pioneered the outsourced sports book. They probably helped the experience for everybody because everyone had to step up their game somewhat when Cantor first took over the Venetian and Emeril Lagasse's. Those were good experiences for the customer. So they had some innovative ideas. But to me, the gold mine that they had was via their parent, Cantor Fitzgerald. They talked to the largest pools of capital in the United States every single day that they were trading stocks and bonds. This would have been such an easy synergy to tell them about how they were going to launch the sort of the entity betting sales coverage in Nevada, and that all it would require would be for these, for somebody, one of these funds to put someone in Nevada. To me, Cantor was the perfect conduit to do all this. And then also, as you kind of touched on, I had a hand in, you know, the creation of some derivative-like betting products, markets, essentially, that were extremely popular on the street. And I thought it would enhance the user experience if they could ever be rolled out, you know, legally in a sports book. So I viewed, at the time, I was like, man, Cantor is an organization that is really well suited to do a lot of things. The problem was, as we know, they had the wrong guys in the seats. You said they changed their name. I kind of view it as an airline that changes their name after they plow into the side of a mountain. You know, people forget right. That the name used to be Allegheny. They had problems, but those problems resulted in the asset essentially being orphaned by the financial institution. So here you have an orphaned asset that they want to spin off and get rid of eventually.
Cantor Fitzgerald orphaning CG Technology.
That's right. And, you know, because after they had run into legal problems, it I think they were viewing it as not a core business and more trouble than it's worth. Now, me, I'm like, this is also on the cusp of PAPSA being repealed. Like, this timing couldn't be better. They want to essentially give this away. So I put together, I became aware of it and got inside, you know, was able to, as a serious buyer, you know, was shown the books and signed NDAs essentially to really understand the business. And I put together, the financial backing to do it. We couldn't pull it off. And as I say, because they're NDAs, I can say that there were issues that price couldn't remedy in making the sale. Just couldn't get the money backers comfortable, and these were professional VCs with some items, and it was fair enough. I understood. So then I tried a different tact, which was to So essentially,
What were some of those items, Joe? Is it as benign as – I mean, they're not benign, but is it the leases that were part of that or something worse than that?
Now, when you have leases, Gil, if there's something like that, you can usually remedy that with price, right? Like it was stuff – I can't go beyond that. But right, if it were just something like, hey, this is an unfavorable lease, we're going to have to lower the price. And like if you couldn't agree on price, that's one thing. But this was just something that you couldn't remedy. Some items there couldn't be remedied one thing that venture capitalists don't like is they don't like regulation that can change without notice. So, and to be fair to backers, anytime a state can come in and change the rules, that can cause some hesitation. So you put that with then some items at the actual asset, and it just couldn't pull it off. So my idea was, okay, I still want to run this thing. Let me try running it as it is. You know, put me. So I went to the company and just I tried so hard. Let me run this. This is worth so much more than you know it is. If we, you know, here's my ideas for the synergy with the financial industry, et cetera. PAPS is going to be passed or it's going to be repealed. You've got a technology play, essentially. This is going to be plug and play. This is why the VCs were so interested in it. They viewed it as a software play, not a gaming play. And these guys,
they're really a data company, right? That was the core.
Right.
They're a data
company. That's another arm. That's another arm is the data element. Yes. Because market makers, we understand, believe me, when I was a market maker, there's ways to run that business profitably, even if you are at an informational disadvantage. And that is something that Cantor should know as well as anyone. So we don't worry, Spanky and Rufus can come in. We'll still make money off that. And Chris knows that. I mean, South Point is an extremely well-run book. I really like how they approach the business. But just all those things combined, it was great. But I'm telling you, Gil, the people at Cantor, they were donkeys. For one thing, they refused to believe. It came to me from the highest levels of Cantor that sports betting will never be legal anywhere at Nevada because Sheldon Adelson has guaranteed me that. And I was like, you mean the Sheldon Adelson that just got clowned by Mark Davis? That guy? That's your weather vane? And, you know, that doesn't go over well necessarily, but I couldn't get them to understand the potential that was there. I couldn't pull it off. And eventually they gave away the assets, because it was too bad. because they really did do some innovations. When I say the wrong guy was in the seat, it was astounding to me how many people within the industry management turned off just with sort of their approach when they got here. Even when I had an attorney to sort of start the licensing for me, he laughed because he said, you know, we were just kind of talking about some stuff, and even he had a story about Cantor management, and his words were, they could have gotten so much more done with a different attitude. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to change that. But that was, never got to. But that would have been fun.
I remember you describing it at the time as, it turns out that Cantor Fitzgerald hates their own business. They hate their own business arm that is CG Technology. And, you know, it explains a lot for why when PASPA was deemed unconstitutional and sports betting was legalized, we heard about DraftKings and every company under the sun moving in, that we never heard a whisper, right? Not even a whisper from CG Technology during that time. And a lot of that explains why that's the case. By the way, I don't know if you're allowed to tell me this, but just for giggles, and by the way, just for factual sake, William Hill did buy the assets of Cantor Gaming, of CG Technology at the time, in 2019. That's a vague way of describing it. They bought the assets of CG Technology, but that's what's been reported. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, if I had 20 million lying around, could I have bought the entirety of CG Technology?
Oh, you could have made an offer. I think you would have been... you wouldn't have been, I don't believe you would have been laughed out of the room.
Well said. Okay. We'll try to work on the technology. I know it's bouncing in and out, and we're trying to get every little detail that Joe talked about. We'll do one more segment, Joe, because I want to come back how you transitioned after this from your entire baseball betting experience, the flirtation, more than a flirtation, obviously, with CG Technology, and how you transitioned to golf and wrote this 2019 Joe Pita's Masters Tour Guide book, which we had you on the air talking about, the discoveries you made. Tiger eventually ends up winning the Masters. I'm sure you had to be sort of fortified by that, or at least validated by that. We'll get into that transition and maybe even get some thoughts on how you feel about baseball saying, yeah, none of these agreements come to pass. We may just end up playing a 50-game schedule. That'll be fascinating. Joe Pita, the guest today, author, former Wall Street and Wall Street exec, and find out what Joe's doing these days, which you should probably have asked earlier, but we'll talk about that coming back right here on A Numbers Game at VSiN.
It's A Numbers Game with your host, Gil Alexander.
It's one of those idiots who believe in analytics.
Hour number two of A Numbers Game right here at VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Gil Alexander, SiriusXM Channel 204, VSiN.com, the VSiN app, Fubo, Sling, Game Plus. Joe Pita with us still, kind enough to hang out through the break here. And Joe, I was just telling you off air, you know, one of the nice things about, you know, you try to make lemonade out of lemons. And so this pandemic obviously has been the most surreal, strange time in so many ways in all of our lives. And, you know, we got to do a show. And, you know, when this started, I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. You know, SVP would say the same thing on SportsCenter. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but we'll figure it out. And so one of the things that I decided to do was go into this sort of Roy Firestone mode for sports betting. And it's so, you know, because if not now, when, right? I'll never get the chance to do this in the middle of a sports season. But it's been so fascinating because, you know, you get the originators like Alan Boston on one end of the spectrum. You get the Spankies of the world. I shouldn't even say the Spankies of the world, because Spanky's one of a kind on his end of the spectrum in what he does with his network in sports betting. I don't know if I know a guy who does not deal in sports betting on a day-to-day basis that is as much a part of sports betting, or probably is more entrenched in sports betting without actively being in it, as you have been over the years for all of these reasons. You did trading bases. You had that experience in 2012. Then this entire Cantor Gaming arc that went on for years, first trying to buy them, putting together the money, then saying, you know what? All right, you don't want this? Let me run it. And so I just find that fascinating. That tells me, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that there's still this itch for you. And I wonder if that itch has been scratched for the last time or if you think it'll come up again.
I would still like to help innovate the industry with some product offerings. I still think I have that to bring to the table for somebody that's what I would call the sell side. That's the, you know, the originator side of the counter. So I would, that is something I've sort of backburnered as exploring, because I did go, one of the other things I did that I didn't mention about in the CG arc was through, you know, a lot of the people that I had met or entities I had met, I went to just about everybody I could that was an existing book to talk about a strategic transaction, which is, you know, usually means M&A, you know, some sort of merger or acquisition. I wanted to team up, and there was a case where original management at CG had burned so many bridges that just mentioning what I was trying to do made people leery. And which was, you know, that's they made that bed. I was going to try to change that culture, but that was certainly an obstacle as well.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, you go through this, and then the last iteration of Joe Pita that my audience is aware of, and this is what's been so amazing over the last decade, Joe, is you've had so many different tentacles. I said this at the beginning. Then you go golf, and you do Joe Pita's 2019 tour guide, Masters Preview, which is like this pivot where everybody was like, whoa, what's Pita doing? I thought he was the baseball guy. I didn't know he was into golf. And this was no run of the mill thing. You were like, I'm going to do this the way that I do everything, and I'm going to deep dive it. And you got access to something nobody else has ever done, has gotten access to, I should say.
Yeah, that's right. So again, you're always looking like, what would the hook for a book be? Because the first thing when you're writing a book, the first thing you really should ask yourself is, could this be a magazine article? And if it could be, then you don't have a book. So as I was diving into golf analytics, and I saw a much less explored subject matter than certainly baseball. What we didn't talk about was I had been writing at ESPN for 3 years, and felt like I was done with baseball.
Let me just step in real quick, Joe, to identify ourselves. It's Gil Alexander, Joe Pita, right here on A Numbers Game at VSiN, the Sports Betting Network, Sirius XM Channel 204. Yeah, I completely glossed over that you wrote baseball for ESPN for so many years. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, mostly at Chalk, but some of it was on the main site as well. And just kind of felt like I had been writing those previews that now for like 7 years. Every team, you know, 700 to 1,000 words a team. How many different ways could I say cluster luck, right? Like I didn't feel like I had, plus the analytics had improved so much, I didn't really feel like I had much more to add there.
Tell the truth, though, Joe. The rubber hit the road when that Hamilton piece never made the light of day. That's the truth.
There was some ill. I'll put it like this. There were talks about full time employment. At the same time, the timing just kept being wrong. Whether it was just hiring freezes, layoffs elsewhere, and then when they were ready, maybe something was going on in my profession. Chad left, he was a big champion of mine there. But the experience overall was great. But I remember when we were talking about a full-time job, I was, and it was going to expand much more beyond Chalk. I remember being told by two different either editors or senior producers, et cetera, you know, we need the Bill Barnwell of baseball. And at the same time, I was told we would like a Bill Simmons tone without the misogyny, right? And so I was like, okay, I'm taking that as a marching order, and then wrote on spec a preview for the 2016 playoffs. And yes, it was a Hamilton-themed one. And It didn't get
your
published.
Your daughters loved Hamilton at the time. Yeah.
Well, I did. So did I. That to me was exactly what they were looking for. And on top of that, as you know, it correctly predicted every single playoff series in 2016 before they were played. So it could have been something that they would have, constantly been going back to. And plus, at this point, we had been building up a pretty nice viewership in terms of page views and the video hits, et cetera, for the writing. So I just kind of felt like this is the launching pad. Should I be as serious about this as maybe not? And that's when I was like, okay, let's turn to something else and golf. And you were mentioning, I was talking about you need a hook. Well, as I started looking into golf analytics, I could tell it wasn't heavily covered, which makes it sort of a green field for writing. But then I also found on the Masters website, stroke by stroke data for the 2018 Masters that was comparable to the ShotLink data that all, PGA Tour analytics are based on. But because this wasn't owned by the PGA Tour and not run by the PGA Tour, they didn't have this data. So I took it and created the book, previewing essentially the 2019 Masters and using all the data from 2018. And that was fun, right? Totally new area, totally new readership. And that was a wonderful time. It was nerve-wracking before, because unlike a baseball season where your stuff plays out over 162 games, I had a unique top 10 for that tournament, and especially the winner having projected Tony Finau to win, and that was a true projection. That was not a based on the value, this is where you should put your money. Like, this was my pick to win. And his odds kept getting worse as tee times approached. So I was very nervous on the eve of the Masters. I did have Tiger Woods third. I was high man on Tiger. I didn't really like his futures price by any means. But in terms of, what I thought his potential were, and that he had, I wrote it, why he had a real chance to win. And hopefully, sort of keyed some people into some new stuff about that tournament, and how to handicap golf. I think it was successful because Rufus had me on his podcast and shut me down on two different topics that he did not want disclosed.
That's when you know it's right. That's when you know it's good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Do you have plans different versions of this, Joe, in the future?
Well, we didn't talk about 2020, Gil. Gil, I dropped 2020 the March 11th. Which was the Wednesday before I dropped it the night before the Players was supposed to tee off, which was the Wednesday night that all hell broke loose. And yes, the 2020 preview is just in digital format. So it's more of an addendum. I sort of update any chapters from the original book that would be different. For instance, if it was 2018 data, now I have all the 2019 data. And if it was 2019 projection, now it's a chapter that's a 2020 projection. So yes, that's there. We'll see how relevant it is in November. Obviously, we're not going to get, current form is going to be very different. But as I put in the book, course history matters more at this event than any other by a mile. So, we'll see how that preview goes as well. But last year was fun.
Where's
Tony Finau? Made my, obviously those first, the Saturday of the Masters was one of the most enjoyable experiences I've ever had, seeing him play his way into the final group on Saturday.
Yeah, your anticipation, no one, Tony Finau had no idea how much you were into Tony Finau that day. You were more staked in him than he might've been himself. But Tiger ends up doing this thing. So a couple of loose ends here. Some of which is my fault. One, where is that available again? 2020 version?
Yeah, that it's not. If you go to my Twitter feed, it's being sold through an online publisher. Because it's been a couple months, I can't even. The link is there in my Twitter bio. And certainly as we get closer to the event, you know, I'll come on, we'll do a piece, you know, stuff like that.
Okay.
But that it's that's the only place it's available. This was really for people who enjoyed the first one. This was hey, here's the work I would do. And here, I'm going to dump it in your lap as well.
Yeah. At Magic Rat SF, tribute to Bruce Springsteen. At Magic Rat SF is Joe's Twitter. I also interrupted you. You were saying Rufus shut you down a couple times and you got excited about saying something else. Do you remember what it was? And then I veered you to the 2020 version. It'll come into your head. Tell us this for people who missed it. You uncovered as part of your book, and this has nothing to do with anything, but just an amazing stat. You uncovered the greatest, maybe the greatest Tiger stat there ever was in that 2019 version. Do you remember what that was?
Yeah, it's his plus stroke gain streak. And uncovered's unfair because Mark Brody did write about it first. At the time, I didn't know about it. Mark Brody, of course, being the godfather of all golf stats. But I did tell the story of how I stumbled on it, and he nearly had a perfect year, where every single round that he played for the entire, and it was more than the calendar, it was more than a 12-month period, but so he had the Tiger stroke game streak, and then the calendar stroke game streak, his entire 2000 season, the very last round of the year, which was in Valderrama in Spain in November during a WGC event, he lost it. He lost that streak of gaining strokes on the field. And I believe it was in the 80s, 86 or 92. It might have been 86 straight rounds. Nobody ever gets above like in the teens. It's an unbelievable streak. We had fun talking about it. I wrote about it in the book. We heard when we talked about it on air, Chris the Bear Felica called in. He had the scorecard, which I couldn't find.
Yes. And while you were on air with me. That's right.
And it turns out he went like double, triple to finish the round. He literally choked. But then it turns out he didn't choke because I heard from a guy who was at that event. And he was a Canadian guy, and he was following Mike Weir, who was in the group behind Tiger. Weir actually won that event. And it turns out those greens had baked out. And the 17th at Valderrama slopes from back to front down with a lake in front of the green. And it was apparently near impossible with the baked out green to actually put a ball on the green. And there is a story that I later found, I think from Alan Shupnik, who was in the locker room after Tiger Room's last round of 2000, and Tiger was taking a club and destroying his bag and locker. He was so mad about the condition of the course. And all those go together. And the funny thing is, I still don't think Tiger knows
say. Yeah, like this is such an amazing thing. We don't know that he was even aware of that. And if he had known and to have lost it like that, oh my God. Because you could say, he wouldn't care about such a thing. Yeah, it was a pretty unbelievable streak. Strokes gained, which is the foundation of everything. In Joe Pita's Masters Tour Guide. So for those wondering, because I'm sort of bearing what you're doing now, and your dog wants to know this as well, what are you actually doing with your life these days? What does Joe Pita do on a day-to-day basis now?
Yeah, I have a new job in the financial industry that I took last summer, and that's why the 2012 book was not a full book. It was a new role, and it was just, I love it, but it was not going to allow me the time needed to actually write a full book. I'm sorry about the dog. It must be walk time. So that's what I do now. So I'm still in the financial industry, and that's why anything, you know, these other ideas about the industry, those are all sort of backburnered.
Yeah. Okay. But you plan on, I mean, I don't know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I know that this job is all consuming for you, but you work for, who's the gentleman you work for, a hedge fund work for? Steve Cohen, is that who it is?
As is publicly available on some other sites, yes, I work for a firm, an asset management firm called Point72. which was founded by a gentleman named Steve Cohen. That is correct.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Any insight on the New York Mets acquisition? Because I know that he was named when it came to the Mets. Let me push the envelope here, as they say.
Yeah. Well, we were certainly excited at the firm to hear about it. I don't know anything beyond, the firm, the from what we were told, the purchase itself would not have been made by our firm, but would have been, it would have been a family purchase, which means it wasn't part of our business. But it was exciting. I think, I was certainly excited by, remember, I love the overlap between asset management and Moneyball, right? I think it would have been very interesting to have an owner with an analytical Wall Street background. I would have loved to see if that would have worked. But, as far as the details, I read them just like you do in the paper. And one thing, so as far as it, not coming together, again, I know what you know in the paper. I will say that we have an expression on the trading floor that we say, good miss. Maybe you were late to the counter to put a bet down on the team that's quickly, good miss. If the reports are correct in how that transaction did not come to fruition, a good miss, right? Like, oh my God. And if you're a selling partner who, is missed out on a multi-billion dollar sale, and I can't imagine you're happy. I can't imagine you think, and this segues into your next piece on baseball. I can't imagine you think that asset is going to be worth what it was, for quite some time now.
Yeah. I'll just wrap it up with this, Joe, and I'll get into the 50 game thing with baseball, but it just seems to me that what's the expression? Just when you think you're out, right? They come pull you back in. You just end up through no real design, right? Like you didn't, whether it's this job now that happens to have this flirtation with buying, the Mets or whatever it is, what we see in reports, whether it's, just the nature of the CG technology arc. You just seem to get reeled in a very, I don't know, the universe just reels you into sports betting and to sports itself. So I'm guessing we haven't heard the last from you. That's just a hunch. I don't know if I have nothing behind that, but I get the sense that you also feel that way, don't you? Like, don't you think that this is not your last chapter?
You surround yourself with people. If you like to surround yourself with people who have similar interests, things can pop up, right? And I think that's the whole point of networking, right? Surround yourself by smart people who have similar interests, and a lot of times you don't know what's around the corner.
And I think there is more than one person listening to this now. And this is, I'm going to toot your horn for you, Joe, that has to be listening to this and has to say to themselves, this dude is unique and might be the guy that I need to run this. Because there's so many now with legalization, there's so many different, ways to skin the cat in sports betting and so many different positions, so many different pieces of expertise one needs. And so, not that you're not happy doing what you're doing, because I know it's bigger than most things, but that occurs to me as well. Joe Pita, author of Trading Bases, still available where all books are sold. A great book about modeling, and then about his history, about his summer of 2012, and then Joe Pita's tour guide, 2019 Masters, but now in a 2020 digital version. If you want to stay for 5 minutes, Joe, we could do the 50-game baseball thing, because I want to get your thoughts. Can I do that? Five more minutes?
Well, no. Let's do it.
Joe Pita. I radioed him. I said, hey, would you mind staying after the break? Coming back on A Numbers Game at Visa, the Sports Betting Network.
Welcome back to A Numbers Game with Gil Alexander.
It is Gil Alexander. Joe Pita, hang out with us this hour. Chrissy Andrews still to come. Joe, sad news from the NBA. Wes Unseld has passed away. Wes Unseld at the age of 74. former Washington Bullets great and a guy who was beloved by team owner Abe Pollin so much that he became the Bullets head coach. He was the Bullets GM. He was the Bullets VP in years after his playing career. But most notably was the NBA's MVP and Rookie of the Year. So he's the MVP his rookie season in 1969. Played at Louisville before that in college. Ended up winning a NBA championship with the Washington Bullets. He, the Big E, Elvin Hayes, and Bobby Dandridge, led the Bullets in 1978 to the NBA title. I was a kid, a little kid when that happened. And all I can say from those days is, and you pointed this out off break, because whenever I bring it up, you made the key point. Those were the 2 years before Bird and Magic, when the Bullets beat the Sonics in 78 and the Sonics beat the Bullets in 79. When the Bullets won the NBA championship, Sports Illustrated ran the story on page 75. Oh, by the way, the Bullets won the NBA championship. Think about that.
Yeah, that really is a before and after.
Yeah. Wes Unseld, what a great guy. Passing away, he had a complication.
Of course, the fourth.
Yeah, complications.
I was thinking about, you mentioned Dandridge and Big E, and then 75-year-old Tom McMillan with the gray hair, right? And
Tom McMillan was after that. Tom McMillan played for the Bullets in the 80s. 75 was the when the Golden State Warriors and Rick Barry swept the Bullets.
Okay. I can just picture that. Those uniforms and the mop of gray hair. Yes.
R.I.P. Wes Unseld. All right, Joe. Listen, a lot of our time the past couple months has been filled with, hey, here's the latest NHL plan, or here's the latest NBA. The NBA really has like four plans a day, it seems like. But baseball, man, listen, I've been one of the few people. This is a strike. This has nothing to do with a pandemic anymore to me. This is a strike. This is 1994. It feels like there's a bunch of owners. We know from reporting that there's a few owners who don't want this to get played. They had to know, the owners, that their latest offer to the players last week was going to fall just dead to the players on arrival. But Jeff Passan reports yesterday, he goes, look, this isn't being proposed officially, but there is this thing in motion that if none of these other plans work out, that Major League Baseball is prepared as a default to play a 50-game range season that would pay players full prorated salaries. And I've made this remark the whole time, like, I can't believe baseball purists of all people have been okay with, yeah, realignment, DH in both leagues. Like, they're like, any baseball is better than no baseball. And I've always been like, what? Really? What do you think about a 50-game season, Joe?
Yeah, the whole thing, you're right. They're stepping all over themselves. And you say strike, I would term it a lockout more than a strike, because
yes,
I think you're
maybe so
correct in saying it's the owners who don't want to abide by the first agreement that they struck back in March, right? In terms of the proration, they want to take it further from there. It is amazing to me how disorganized this industry looks compared to the especially basketball. I mean, you see them working together, and this does seem, certainly when you get a guy like Max Scherzer as your spokesman, who would stand to lose more than anyone except like Garrett Cole, right? And by not playing, he's firing heat at the owners. So I am skeptical that anything would happen. 50 games, yeah. It's do you just make them division games? I mean, I don't know. It's almost like, yeah, it's so hard to kind of wrap your arms around what this would look like or how it would be helpful. But yeah, what are your thoughts? Do you think it's going to happen?
I can't imagine 50 games happening. First of all, somebody's going to win the batting title with a 515 batting average, and somebody's going to win the home run title with 19 dingers, right? It's like, it's just, the whole thing is so ridiculous that I'm like, who wants this? Like, who would even, not only that, though, every day and every week that goes by, baseball will get pushed into this, you know, the golf majors and football, like, nobody cares at that point. Nobody cares now. Joe, I got to run, man. I've enjoyed it. I apologize for keeping you over, but these commercials come when I least want them to. Thank you,
as
man.
Always.
And best of luck. We'll talk soon. We'll talk before the Masters.